So if you want to be looking at the page while we're waiting for the other people. You look at page 22. Well, no, that's still the summary, so we leave that one now. Fourth chapter begins on page 41, 41. Just going to, you know, keep fourth chapter gets this. It's in a lot of complications in there, which aren't, I wouldn't call them essential complications. So just sort of get the overview and move on, really. So keep it simple by just going along according to the text, the study manual. So this is a study manual for people doing the basic program sort of full time. So there's a lot of material in here which we can't really even talk about because it'll just be too much for us in our sort of much briefer study of it. So what it says on page 41 then, just talking about the application in complete aspects. So the fourth of the eight clear realizations. So we've got the three that we want to cultivate: the knower of bases, knower of paths, and exalted knower of all aspects. And so this is, you know, how we train in those. And you know, the first one is he's training in a knower of bases. So the person who's in the here a vehicle, the person who's limited, middling type of being who says I want to get to my liberation, he's training in a knower of bases, he or she. And then the Bodhisattva is also training in the knower of bases because he wants to be able to teach those people. He wants his own, you know, he's got to discover those truths that the knower of bases realizes. He's got to realize them for himself, of course, you know, with the extra add-ons that he's got. And then, you know, he wants to be able to teach people, so he very much has to practice the knower of bases as well. And so that's knower of bases is basically, you know, the meaning of the four truths. So if you just go to liberation, you have to know the four truths very well, and, you know, the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. So that's maybe the one you meditate on most of all is the selfness of persons. So out of the 16, you know, aspects of the Four Noble Truths, selfness of persons, you'll find that's one of the aspects. So that's the one they meditate on most of all. Yeah, so then, you know, that's the first part of the training, that's as far as we got last time. And then the Bodhisattva also trains in the Knower of Paths, which is another set of these, out of the 173 aspects. You see that some are for the Knower of Bases, some are for the Knower of Paths, and some are, you know, ones sort of, you know, sort of associated with Knower of All Aspects. So at the end of the second paragraph there, so thus, the last two sentences in the second paragraph, thus the Bodhisattva generates the three exalted knowers in his continuum by meditating on the 27 aspects of knower of bases, the 36 aspects of knower of paths, and the 110 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects. These together are a total of 173 aspects. So when somebody asks you what's the first topic in the main topic of the the fourth chapter, application in complete aspects, you can mention those. So all of the four applications, practice those 173 aspects, as we said. This is where you sort of, the first one, application in complete aspects, begins on the path of accumulation. This is where you start doing it. This is where you, you know, gaining mastery, as they call it. So just to look at page 42 then. The second paragraph, an application in complete aspects. What is it? So it gives you a couple of different explanations. Page 42, you know, the second paragraph. An application in complete aspects is an application which a bodhisattva cultivates, in which the bodhisattva cultivates 173 aspects collectively, or an exalted wisdom that is conjoined with or accompanied by this application. So it says cultivates them collectively, as if he's doing them all at once. I don't think it means that. It means cultivates them together, but without them. It doesn't mean he's doing them all simultaneously. He's doing them one after the other. Maybe collectively is a good enough word, I suppose, but it means like he does them together. Yeah, but so it's like, you know, you're looking at one, then you look at another, then you look at another, just looking around from your castle, you're looking down at the town, okay, but you don't look at all the town at once, you look at this bit, and look at that bit, and look at that bit, look at that bit. But you're doing them all, you know, don't miss anything out now. So you're cultivating 173 aspects collectively. Or it's an exalted wisdom that is conjoined with or accompanied by this application. So, you know, from this point on then, you have all those in mind, yeah? So it's not necessarily that you're actually focusing on one of the 173 aspects. You can be, if you're a bodhisattva, thinking about bodhicitta. But your meditation on bodhicitta will be sort of warmed by, will be kind of influenced by, will be supported by your meditation on 173 aspects, yeah? So it's like if you're meditating on emptiness, you can't be meditating on conventional truth at the same time. If you're meditating on emptiness, you can't be meditating on bodhicitta at the same time. I mean, if you're a Buddha, okay, but if you are an ordinary being, you've got to be meditating on conventional truth or ultimate truth. You can't do them both at the same time. But you can meditate on bodhicitta and then go into your meditation on emptiness. Only meditation on emptiness is, they say, is then held by the bodhicitta that you've just been meditating on. It's like kind of warmed or supported by it. You see? Conjoined with it, as they say. Or if you meditate in an emptiness, then you go into meditate on bodhicitta, your meditation on bodhicitta will be enhanced by that sort of, the kind of, you know, the strong feeling left behind by your just previous meditation on emptiness, you see. So it's how those two mutually support each other. That's what they're talking about conjoined with or accompanied by. So, you know, that's how the bodhisattva proceeds. So always with these 173 aspects, 173 meditations are kind of, you know, in mind now. So he's got to practice them. And he practices them, you see, in the last paragraph there, he'll be practicing them from the path of the Mahayana path of accumulations, which is the lowest Mahayana path, all the way through to the end of the continuum of a sentient being. So he's continued to practice like this. Once his practice gets to a certain level, then you can say it's also, you know, the next stage, you know, the peak practice or the serial practice or the, you know, instantaneous practice. But it's still a practice of the application in complete aspects. So that goes all the way through to the end of Buddhahood. So even though you start to speed up and, then you start to call it by these other names, you know, like serial practice and instantaneous practice and so on, still, it's still a practicing complete aspects. So it's pretty well all the Mahayana path, you know, is from path of all the Mahayana paths of training, from path of accumulation all the way to the end, you know, end of the continuum of the sentient being when you become a Buddha. So all those paths of training are all application in complete aspects. Okay, well, that's just. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not like first application starts and then the second application begins. It's like the first one continues, and it's like the second one is just when you get to a certain skill in it, it becomes a second one as well. Yeah. Yeah. So this one is, very much goes all the way through to last moment before Buddhahood. So then we've got the 11 topics of the application of complete aspects, which, we just won't have time to look at some of them. And if we do look at them, we'll look at them quite quickly. And, just getting the general meaning rather than the individual meaning. We'll try to get some sort of specific meanings as well, but, just have to be very selective. So the first topic of the application of complete aspects was this nine aspects of the antidotal class explicitly indicated in this context. So that's, I'm just reading from the bottom of page 42 now, yeah, of this handbook. So that's the 173 aspects of the three exalted knowers. Page 42. So number two, principal applications explicitly indicated in this context. So these are the principal applications that a Bodhisattva engages in, but they are given sort of different names and so on. So, that's just extra sort of complication, really. I think we might avoid that grouping. Number three, excellent qualities of a Mahayana application. Okay. So these are the good qualities or, the good features of doing these applications, doing these trainings. So number four, faults of the application. So these are where, the things that will make it more difficult, the things that will prove to be hindrances in doing the applications. So number five, yoga of the path of perfection of wisdom. So that's also known as characteristics or something. So there's obviously different names for that one. But just further descriptions of what these applications are about. But again, it's a bit sort of overcomplicated for me, that one. Number six, the Mahayana partial concordance of liberation, explicitly indicated in this context. So this is the Mahayana path of accumulation. So it's a little bit more something we could talk about. Get some idea of grounds and paths. So you don't have a separate teaching on that in the basic program, and so this is where you'll learn about it, where you can sort of learn a bit more about it. So perhaps we'll say something about the paths next weekend. Pardon? Well, on the schedule I saw, there wasn't. Can you answer that question, Mike? Is there a teaching on grounds and paths, a separate teaching in the basic program?
No.
No. And there isn't one on the 70 topics either, in the way you're doing it here?
No. Mm.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I thought we could do some of that next weekend, because when you get to topics number six, that's the path of accumulation, and number seven, path of preparation, so it's not talking about all the paths, methodically and, giving you an overview, but that's a kind of a jumping off point for talking about a bit more about how you go from path to path and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, I gave you at least a sheet with them on, didn't I? A presentation of them, basic presentation. A bit easier to understand than the one in this book. The one in this book tries to cram in more information. Very commendable, but you might find yourself puzzling over it a bit. So that's something, by the time we get to, say, next weekend, we could probably jump, I thought, to six and seven, maybe, to do something about grounds and paths. But it depends how far we get this weekend, doesn't it? So number eight, the Bodhisattva Sangha, who has achieved a sign of irreversibility. So the Bodhisattvas who don't turn back, what signs are that they show. And then 9, 10, and 11 are, looking towards the Buddha ground then, looking towards the Buddha body. So that's looking towards chapter 8. So number 9, application of the equality of cyclic existence of peace. So this is applications that give rise to the truth body of a Buddha. So the truth body, let's say, just for the time being, that's the wisdom of a Buddha, so the wisdom of non-duality, you know. The wisdom of equality, you know, in emptiness, cyclic existence, and nirvana, just equal. They're both equally empty of, you know, true existence. So some sort of equality like that is meant here. So that's the wisdom realizing non-true existence. Number 10, application of pure land. This presents the applications that give rise to the complete enjoyment body of a Buddha. Okay, so it's not enough for a Buddha just to have the wisdom and, you know, be marvelously adept at meditating on the emptiness of their own mind and everything, but they need to be able to arise and, without arising from their meditation, without arising from their meditative equipoise, let's say, they involve in, you know, working for and teaching others. So that's, you want those bodies, the bodies of form which they can present themselves to others. So this is the enjoyment body, a very high level kind of form body through which the Buddha teaches the great high bodhisattvas. And then the applications of skillful means, number 11, and this is the special trainings that give rise to the emanation body of a Buddha. So that's the body of a Buddha who might come down to our level. The Buddha who taught under the Bodhi tree 2,000 so on years ago, this would be a supreme emanation body, you know. So the actual sort of the most marvelous type of emanation body of all. But there are other different kinds of emanation bodies. So this is, you know, looking towards that final result, the resultant body. So we can sort of look at that maybe at the last weekend through the medium of those applications and look a bit at the 8th chapter perhaps. Okay, so that's just an overview of the 11 topics in the 4th chapter. It doesn't tell us very much, but as I say, don't worry. Some of those topics are really... we won't go into them, you know. Even if we did have more time, it'd still be best to, you know, just pass over them, really, because there isn't a lot that we can sort of gain from them, I don't think. So it's much better to pick and choose. And that's, after all, how we studied this text, you know. Even though we studied it for 6-7 years, we didn't do all the text. You know, we left out chapter 3, we left out chapter 6, chapter 7, didn't study them at all. And chapter 5, you just study the 12 links of dependent origination. So in the Gelugpa system, you don't study every topic and give it each an equal amount of time. That's not the idea at all. It's like this is a whole treasure trove of, you know, just sort of a vast sort of treasure house, and you just pick out the bits which you can, you know, are going to be useful to you, are going to be sort of, you know, more, you can connect with bits that are sort of more familiar or more kind of, you know, interest in them, more sort of juice or more sort of, you know, central relevance. And those are bits like in the first chapter you study Bodhicitta, the four truths, the two truths and so on. So you study the things that, you know, have come over from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras into the mainstream, into the Lamrim texts and so on. So you're just studying those things in greater depth. And so that's how you do it. You get an overview, you get some idea of the magnificent, sort of inspiring kind of, what the whole palace looks like. But when you go into the palace, you don't have time to look at all the different rooms. And that would be very repetitive anyway, so you just go to the rooms where there's something really interesting, something that's, you know, in tune with your aspirations and enjoy the treasures in that room, and then go on to somewhere else. So that's how we're doing it. Now, and so that's, if you remember, then we've got into the Nara aspects first group, which is the 27 aspects. Of the Nara basis. So you can see where they are on page 48. Yeah? So do you remember we stood the 27 aspects of the Nara basis? So we looked at the end of the third weekend last year at the four aspects of true sufferings. you remember doing that? Do you remember what they are? Impermanence, suffering, emptiness, and selflessness. Yeah, so they're written down here. It's on page 50. If you turn over the page, they're written. So even, you know, even if you study the Four Truths a little bit beyond the beginner level, you'll come across these 16 aspects. I mean, for instance, they're in Geshe Tashi's book about the Four Noble Truths, I'm sure, aren't they? Yeah, so those of you who've done Geshe Tashi's course, you know, you'll have met them. I don't see this, you know, they're sort of, you're supposed to do a six-month retreat on each aspect or anything like that. But definitely the first four, which we did a little bit last weekend, you know, the last weekend of last year, impermanent, suffering, empty, selfless. So they are, obviously, you know, they're really like sort of central to the Buddhist path, aren't they? So they are the nature of samsara, and then, you know, the antidote, those are the wisdom realizations, which, you know, you use to counter your present bewilderment. So there's a lot packed in there. And we're going to go on to things like the four placements of mindfulness and so forth, which are coming up. They're also part of these 173 aspects, so we're going to come back to these. So that's how it was when you're studying the perfection of wisdom in depth, you know, ornament for clear realizations. So the main topics like impermanence, suffering, empty, and so on, they keep coming back. So they'll keep bringing around to these. It's not like you study them once and you leave them behind. The pattern of the text is like it's very cyclical, you know, you keep coming back to things that are very important, like the Four Noble Truths and the four aspects of the First Noble Truth. And in there, then, you've got empty and selfless. Well, impermanent, well, no time to talk about them, really, except just to say now, so there you've got the emptiness as posited by the Hera school. Yeah? The Hera vehicle, let's say, the hearers. You know, what do you meditate on then to get rid of your, you know, your obscurations preventing liberation? If you're a hearer, and says, oh, what you need to know, what you need to meditate on is what? Yes, and what shall we understand by the selflessness of persons? Yeah. Yeah, it's got a funny long name, and I'm not sure at all sure the name describes it very well. But that's how it is. The word substantial is there, so it's the emptiness, or, you know, the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. The lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay, so this is like a core sort of selflessness, according to, you know, the higher school Prasangika and so forth. They say, oh, you never get out of meditate, out of cycle existence meditating on that. But we're not talking about the Prasangika view here. So this is the way the hearers get out of cycle existence, meditating on this particular selflessness of persons. So that selfness as a person is associated with the Hera vehicle, you know, the lower level. Yeah. Obviously, bodhisattvas have to realize it. Obviously, Buddhas realize it because they realize all phenomena. So they know that it's there and they've meditated on it. So they know exactly what it's all about. So it's not like this only hearers meditate on that. It's not. We don't mean that. But the hearers, by meditating on it, will get to their level of freedom. You know, they'll get to their nirvana. So, yeah, according to the Svatantrika, you know, the Yogacara, Svatantrika, Madhyamakas, that's all you need to get out of cyclical existence, right? So we talked a little bit about that last time, so I'm not going to go into that now. Okay, so that's the four aspects of the truth of suffering. Then there's the four aspects of the true origins. Are we on page 50? Yeah? You following? So then there's four aspects of the truth of cessations. Now, in a normal presentation of the four truths, just like in Geshe Tashi's book, then you'll have the four aspects of true paths. Right? But here you've got 15 aspects of the true paths. So we're not keeping to the regular standard in a Lamrim presentation. We've got extra add-on bits here, which is typical of the Ornament for Clear Realizations. It's typical of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That they add bits on, or they kind of, you know, instead of using the standard terminology, oh, impermanent, suffering, empty, selfless, they use different words. And it's only like, you know, the sort of ingenuity of the commentators that keep it, you know, like by explaining these words, these new words, they say, oh, that just means impermanent, that one just means suffering, and that one just means empty. You know, so it's the commentators who keep it sort of, who are needed to explain the sort of funny terminologies of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So we're trying not to get into too many complications, but this is the point at which we can, you know, go right down now to dive into, you know, the ground level appreciation of just a few points. Okay, it's not going to be like wonderfully revealing, but so why are the 15 aspects of true paths instead of the normal four? That's the question. Okay, well, the normal four begin at the bottom of page 51. And it says, four aspects of true paths that are uncontaminated paths of seeing. Four aspects of true paths that are uncontaminated aspects of the uncontaminated paths of seeing, which are antidotes to the afflictive obscurations, directly realize selflessness. Okay. So, these are the normal four aspects, right? So there's number 13, path, 14, suitability, 15, achievement, 16, deliverance. So if you're doing Geshe Tashi's book or presentation of the normal 16, those are the ones you'll get. And the explanations aren't particularly, you know, sort of amazing or kind of... you know, it's not like it's the sort of something really incredible, special about them. Path, 13. It means yes, this is a path. This is a path that leads you out of cyclic existence. This is the path of an antidote. So this is your means to cure yourself of your addiction to cyclic existence. And then suitability just means, you know, this is a very suitable path in the fact that it's an effective path. You know, these are antidotes to your afflictions. So this path is a suitable path because it is a path which does, you know, damage your afflictions and get rid of them. And I think achievement means something like, yeah, they do achieve what they're supposed to do. You know, they will get rid of your afflictions, so that they'll get rid of them such that they don't come back. Yeah, so they deliver you from, or you definitely emerge from samsara completely by relying on this particular path. And then deliverance is just saying yes. So if you do complete this path and you do get rid of your afflictions, then yes, you are delivered from cyclic existence. It is complete deliverance. It's like you're out of it and you won't go back again. So it's four assertions that this is your effective means to proceed. So that's about all it is, you see. So that's... that's fair enough. But then in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, they don't use the words path, substantiality, achievement, and deliverance. They use other words, like instead of path, you have non-agent. Instead of suitability, you have non-knower. Instead of achievement, you have non-transferer. Instead of deliverance, you have non-tamer. So those are the words which are coming in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Definitely in the 100,000 version, and certainly nothing in the middling version, 25,000. I'm not sure about the 8,000 version. 8,000 version, you know, just condenses it, so they may not occur there, I'm not sure. Anyway, so those are those are the words as they appear in the sutra. So that's the first four of the 15 aspects of true paths. So the ornament for clear realizations is only complicated because the sutras are like that. So then you've got explanations of those. Why does it say non-agent instead of non-path? Well, these are all, all the realizations on the uncontaminated path of seeing are realizations of selflessness. So the path of seeing is what? What's special about your path of seeing and about your realization of selflessness on the path of seeing? Is that right, Jane? What's special about the path of seeing, the realization of selflessness? Thank you. Yes. So, well, what does that mean? You're realizing it directly. Non-conceptually, yes. Just like you're seeing blue with your eye consciousness, you know, just like a baby. They're not thinking, oh, that's blue, you know, this, that, and the other. They're just very open to just what the senses are presenting them with, you know, so the direct perception without the medium of conceptual representation. So they don't have to think about it and say, oh no, it must be empty because it's dependent arising, or it must be selfless because there's no control of self, there's only the five aggregates, you know, wherever we look amongst those aggregates we don't find any other item which could be a self, and so on. They're not using all that kind of creaking sort of methods of thinking. You're just seeing it directly, but not with your eye consciousness, no, with a mental direct perceiver. So it's difficult for us to conceive that what that is, because we don't really have them that we're aware of. So you know, you're not using one of your sense doors, like your hearing power or your seeing power with your eyes. It's sort of a mental direct perceiver. So it's a very high level state, and you have to have your single point of concentration and all this, you know, so they have to have many things in place in order to have that sort of level of realization, never mind. So, what you're realizing basically is the selflessness of persons. So non-agent, it simply means you're realizing that although in general there are persons, however, there is no self-sufficient, substantially existent person who is an agent. You know? We're all agents, we all do things, yeah? We all, you know, do our emails, or you know, we go and run and catch the bus. But according to this level, there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent person who does her emails or goes and catches the bus. So who's doing it then? Just the five aggregates, maybe. In this school, you know, the hero school, it's more like that, isn't it, you know? They kind of deny the existence of the whole and just say the only real thing is the parts. You know? The whole is some sort of convenient kind of, you know, fiction or some convenient thing you can lay over. But actually, what is actually running for the bus when they're late? It's the five aggregates. I don't know. We haven't got time to talk about it. So I'm just sort of trying to go through it. So now we're down at ground level. So these are the finest divisions that the ornament for clear realization is making. So the next one on top of page 52, 14, suitability. So that one in the text, in the sutra, it says non-knower. And it's interpreted to mean that you are realizing a lack or the absence of the self of persons who is a knower. So you lack of the self-sufficient, substantially existent knower. So you're still realizing the absence of selflessness of persons, but what kind of persons? You know, persons in in from the perspective of the persons being knowers, you know. So that's all it's saying. How that ties up with suitability, the usual explanation of the aspect of the truth of past, I'm not quite sure. Achievement. Number 15. So this is indicated in the sutra by non-transferer and presents a lack of a self of persons who is a transferer from inferior states. So the person who transfers from the desire realm to the form realm. A person who transfers from the form realm to the formless realm. So, you know, a person kind of, you know, transfers their state from, you know, one kind of sentient being to another. So this is what it means by transferer. And these transfers are sort of transfers from lower to higher in this case, for some reason. So there's no person who is self-sufficient and substantially existent who transfers, you know, from one realm to another. Okay, we're not saying there isn't anybody who transfers. There are sentient beings who transfer, but they're not self-sufficient, substantially existent transferers. So you meditate on that. So you think about those beings transferring from one state to another, going, you know, through the power of meditation to higher realms of concentration within cyclic existence and so forth. But then you remember that they're all, you know, don't have any self-sufficient, substantial existence at all. And the last one, deliverance. This is indicated by non-tamer, you know, somebody who doesn't control the afflictions. Somebody who's controlling the afflictions or, you know, subduing the afflictions. But what we're talking about, yes, there is the taming and there is the subduing of afflictions, but there is no self-sufficient, substantially existent person who does that. So the person who's taming the afflictions, they're also not self-sufficient, substantially existent. Yeah, so there's not much I can say to make that much clearer. So you're supposed to realize all those 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths on the path of seeing. That's what these hearers do, you know. They realize the complete bundle, you know, the whole of the Four Truths for the first time non-conceptually on the path of seeing. So this is the first time in which they actually remove some of their afflictions. Yeah, you've realized those things conceptually before on the path of preparation and so forth. And that's been very, you know, kind of, you know, it's that's wisdom, you know, that's the wisdom arisen from contemplation. So that's in itself is a great achievement. But that is in itself doesn't actually get rid of any of your afflictions. It subdues them, sure, you know, and it pacifies them. But on the path of seeing, you start to get rid of the actual seeds of the afflictions themselves. But you only get rid of the seeds of the gross afflictions. You don't get rid of the seeds of the you know, the subtle afflictions. So just by reaching the path of seeing and having a great session of, you know, direct realization of selfness as a person, it doesn't mean that you're getting rid of all your afflictions at once, but you're getting rid of some seeds of some gross afflictions, you know. So it's a progress which is kind of irreversible. So some of the seeds of the afflictions are gone by then. Anyway, and the other thing to say is, yeah, so you're realizing that all those 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, but they say what you're meditating on is just selfness as a person. By meditating on that, you know, all the others are kind of somehow implicitly realized or something. You know, you have just the one sort of, you know, supreme meditative object, which is selflessness. And in realizing that, implicitly you realize all those 16 different aspects. Yeah. So somehow the path of seeing has sort of 16 moments, but it's all kind of they're all kind of simultaneous moments or something. And the only object you have is this selfness as a person. That's the only thing you need to meditate on to realize all the Four Truths somehow. Anyway, so that's for the hearers. So that's where we're talking about selflessness as persons. I know it's complicated, but, you know, gradually through acquaintance with the material, it's maybe not as, you know, the main points come through. So that's, you know, what we're looking for. All these sort of minute kind of details that start appearing, I don't think those are kind of, you know, vital to know, even if you, you know, sort of sitting in your debate examination for La Ramba Geshe, you know, don't think they would maybe kind of be going back to these sort of points in this quite such detail, but you never know. Anyway, so that's all how the hearers go about it. Those who are going for individual liberation, meditating on the selflessness of persons, which is the absence of self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay. But there is a complication here, which is explaining why there are 15 paths instead of 4, 15 aspects of the truth of paths instead of 4, and that is because there are these solitary realizer chaps. So they, if you just say three vehicles, you're going to put the solitary realizer in the hearer vehicle. Yeah? They're not practicing the Mahayana mind generation. So they're in the hearer vehicle. They're not in the Bodhisattva vehicle. But, you know, the way the Svatantrik Yogacara, Svatantrik Madhyamikas of, you know, the way they're arranging their grounds and paths, they do have a different object of meditation from the hearers themselves, you know, the hearers we've just been talking about. So if you just lump them all together, they're all hearers, but if you say, well, in the hearer group, who have you got? You've got the ones who just meditate on self-sufficient, substantially existent person, absence of that, and go to their own enlightenment. And then you've got the solitary realizers who meditate on something else. So what do they meditate on? What's their final object that they meditate on? What's the final wisdom they're gazing upon? Yeah. So if you sort of really with it, you'll know that the solitary realizers meditate on one way of saying it is the apprehender and the apprehended being of different substantial entity. Have you heard of that phrase before? They're meditating on the absence, you know, all these selflessnesses and emptinesses, they're all absences, the mere absence of, or the mere lack of, the apprehender and the apprehended being different substantial entity. Well, that's what you said, Steffi. In the book here, it just says absence, the non-existence of external objects. So that'll be an easy one for people. So we're still on page 52. So now we're going to onto these extra aspects of the true paths. So you look in bold, there's two titles. Page 42, 52, it says, five aspects of true paths that are contaminated paths of meditation, and six aspects of true paths that are uncontaminated paths of seeing. Okay, so an extra 11. Right, so underneath it says the five aspects of the true paths that are contaminated paths of meditation are the exalted wisdoms of the Bodhisattva on the path of meditation during subsequent attainment. They realize the non-existence of external objects. Or in other words, you know, so whose view is this? In terms of tenets? Mind-only view. Heard of the mind-only view? So what's the hallmark, or what's the basics of the mind-only view? Stuart?
Is it the modularity of observer and observed, and that they believe that the mind, the consciousness is substantial?
Kind of, yeah. that's basically it. You know, keep it simple for kind of complete beginners. You say, oh, well, the people who don't believe in externally established objects. Yeah? So there's no external matter in this school. No external phenomena. Yeah, so you've got your consciousness and you've got your object. And all the other schools will say, yeah, well, they're different substances, yeah? Here's a consciousness, which is, you know, clear and knowing and all that. And, you know, somewhat distant or outside the consciousness, you can find other objects, you know, which is basically matter, isn't it? So they are... the matter is coming out of its flow of productive causes, you know. Wood is made of whatever, so much carbon, so much hydrogen, so much of this and that, you know, they all come together under some influence of our karma, no doubt, you know, because it's our general environment, so our karma is influencing it. But then you have a tree, or then you have, you know, a piece of wood. But the consciousness is coming out of its own causal stream of previous modes of consciousness, so that's, you know, quite a different type of substance to matter. And then the external object there is like kind of producing the consciousness, seeing it in the sense that the table's there, and then the consciousness pays attention to that area of the visual field, and then, you know, the table gives rise to an eye consciousness seeing it. So that the table's the cause, and the eye consciousness seeing the table is the effect of that. So that's how, you know, we'd ordinarily say the table exists. And that's how all the other schools say it exists. But the mind-only chaps, they're saying something quite different. And their main analogy is, dream consciousness. So if you have a dream of a table, the whole thing's completely different, isn't it? You know? If you dream of a table, it's not like there's a table waiting around in your dream, and then, you know, your dream consciousness catches sight of that table and therefore is generated in the aspect of some sort of external object, external to the mind. It's not like that, is it? If you dream of a herd of elephants when you're tucked up in bed at night, it's not like there's a herd of elephants in your room, is it? So it's not like there's an external herd of elements causing your dream consciousness. Your consciousness at that point to have an experience of a herd of elephants. What's happening? Well, it's more like there's some sort of karmic seed, some sort of buried part of your, whatever, your Freudian unconscious or something, you know, that sort of comes to the surface. Doesn't it? And then somehow your mind takes on the aspect of a herd of rampaging elephants just through the power of its own, you know, capacity to produce appearances. So the appearance of the herd of elephants is simultaneous with the consciousness experiencing that appearance. Okay? So they just come up together. So it's not like one is the cause of the other, is it? And it's not like the herd of elephants is distant or cut off from the eye consciousness seeing it in some sort of, you know, that's one substance, you know, produced by that method of, you know, that series of causes and conditions. And this is the eye consciousness produced from a completely quite separate series of causal conditions. So two different substances there. It's not like that. It's just like when you dream, it's just like that. It's like whatever it is, the imprint or something on your mind just arises, and then it sort of splits into two, maybe. You see, you have the eye consciousness seeing the elephants, and then you have the elephants there, just both arising from the same causal seed. What are they saying then?
You can dream of being run over by a bus or
Yes. Well, if they are called mind only, so you can't have your cake and eat it. Yeah, so, I mean, they would say that such a thing as form exists, yeah? Matter exists. They're not denying that. They're not denying the there's no such thing as blue, or there's no such thing as a, you know, a tree or something. But they're saying it's only an appearance to your mind. Right, so we look at this table, and yes, we have to admit that there is an appearance of table to our mind. Our mind is somehow takes on the aspect of a table. Right, so far so good. But our common assumption is, and behind the appearance of table to our mind, there is somehow an actual table there, which would be there whether we were looking at it or not. Some kind of that would be the external object. And that's exactly what the mind-only school are denying. They're saying, yes, there's an appearance of table, we'll call that form, we'll call that matter. But when you look behind the appearance to find, say, well, now there's an actual object that is a sort of external matter, external form, external particle, then that's what they're denying. So to me, they are denying external phenomena. And that's their... It's an impediment to your progress on the path, you see. We cotton on to these things, we latch on to these things as if they were impermanent, as if they were external. We assent to that appearance of them as external and carry on like that. So we invest them with a lot sort of greater sense of reality than they actually have. You know, then we develop aversion or we develop attachment. You know, all our afflictions come along. But if we could just remember that everything's just like an appearance of a dream to our mind, then our afflictions will be much cut off, yeah? And we'd be able to experience reality then, instead of these bewildering appearances, mistaking those for reality. You know how if you just realize in a dream that things are just mere appearances to your mind, you don't get so carried away by the experience, do you? Yeah. Or if the bus in the dream, just when you're about to be run over by the bus in the dream, you wake up, yeah? So you can say, but even in the dream sometimes it happens, doesn't it? Just before you wake up, you say, oh, this is just a dream. You know, I'm okay. And then you wake up sort of thing, don't you? I don't know. But in the reality, the bus does run you over and you get killed, okay. But you can say, instead of cursing the bus driver, you know, and, you know, sort of in developing some negative mind or something, some mind of anger, you just say, well, it's just production of my own karma. So you just like the way these delusive appearances appear in my dreams, you know, it's all just a production of my own mind. It's all the fruit of my own previous, you know, experiences and actions. So you understand that in terms of a dream. You understand that in reality too. So you don't, get involved in the negative emotions. You just say, oh, well, it's just my karma. You know, it's just the ripening of karma. So you don't get sort of dragged down by your sort of negative emotions. That's a theory, anyway. So you can see how we've got, in the end, we've got three different descriptions of selflessness. You know, we've got the here a different description of selflessness, which only applies to persons, absence of a self sufficient, substantially existent person. So those lower types of hearers meditate on that and go to their own liberation. Then you've got these solitary realizers who are meditating on the classic mind-only type of understanding of selflessness. Now, this is a selflessness as a phenomenon now, so it doesn't just apply to persons, it applies to persons and phenomena, all phenomena. So you meditate on the absence of apprehender and apprehended, being a different substance. Or in other words, you meditate on the absence of, you know, externally existing phenomena. Meditating on that as your main object, you progress through the paths and you go to your own level of nirvana. It's still a personal, solitary nirvana, but it's, you know, more advanced than the one that the lower hearers go to. It's a longer path with different objects of meditation. And then, of course, you've got the bodhisattvas who are going for Buddhahood. Their main object of meditation is a selflessness. Selflessness is a phenomena, so it applies to all persons or non-persons. And that's the absence of true existence. So we talked about that in the first weekend, when I was here, you know, the reasoning of absence of one or many. So anyway, this is getting closer to, you know, it's the middle way type of reasoning. So the bodhisattva's path is now explicitly, you know, explaining middle way type of emptiness. So that's a more subtle kind of emptiness. But you can see how the three vehicles, you know, the three types of meditation for three different types of people. Yeah, the hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas. Yeah. So the one we're on now is the mind only type of realization, which the solitary realizers have got to understand. Okay. So any questions so far? You're all listening very intently. Or maybe not. But you look as if you are so far. Yes, in this school, they would have to be. They don't understand true existence.
When you say this school, you mean this school, the
Yogacara? Yogacara, Svatantrika, Madhyamaka, which is yogic, autonomy, middle way school.
Yeah,
why not? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but by tenet. Mind only by tenet. But they don't meditate on Mahayana, Bodhicitta and all that. They're classed amongst the hearers as being, you know, more self-centered than that. To make that point, we need to look at this one, I think. So here's how this Brunhilzel, Gone Beyond, Volume 1, he just gives you a paragraph on what they mean by solitary or single Buddhas by themselves, which I'm calling, Geoffrey Hopkins generally calls them solitary realizers. So why this solitary single bit of their name? Well, it said that in their last life, before they attain their nirvana, they do it without a teacher. And also, they're very fond of staying in solitude. So sometimes, even when there are no Buddhas appearing on the earth and all the hearers have gone away, the other kind of hearers, these people are still keeping the Buddha's teachers going by meditating for 100 years in solitude, you know, hidden away. Nobody knows they're there, but they're sort of, you know, still keeping the Buddha's teachings alive in these periods of sort of a dearth of Buddha's teachings. So they have to gather a bit more of a merit than the other hearers, so their path to their liberation is a bit longer. So it says they gather accumulations for 100 eons. And so, yes, they go to the liberation in the last life without any teacher.
And it said that, yeah, they're afraid of samsara. So this is like slightly ordinary hearers. They yearn for nirvana. So that's like the ordinary hearers. They have little compassion. So that's the Mahayanas, kind of, you know, looking down on them. So, you know, they don't have the compassion to work for the benefit of masses of beings. And then what else does it say about them? They're also supposed to be very proud. They keep silent, live in solitude. Okay, so they're definitely classed in the hearer bracket. So not Mahayana. When it talks about their obscurations, it calls them coarse obscurations of knowledge. Yeah. So the hearers are getting rid of the obscurations of the afflictions. So once you've done that, that's it. So if the solitary realizer get rid of something beyond that, then it's obscurations of knowledge. But not the subtle ones that you need to remove to get to Buddhahood, but these are coarse level of knowledge obscurations to omniscience. So, if we just have a quick look at the text again, you know, the handbook, just to get the flavour of what's there at ground level. It's not kind of brilliantly illuminating, but it's just we can say we've looked at, you know, points at the sort of finest level of division. So now we're talking about these solitary realizers, and we're talking about them on the path of meditation. So maybe you don't need to worry about that any more than what I've just said. So then number 17, we'll just read what it says in the handbook. I don't know if we can make a lot of sense of it. Being devoid of emptiness. So this is page 52, number 17. Being devoid of emptiness. So that's what it'll say in the sutras. So this is something to do with the emptiness of external objects. Like dreams, they bear the characteristics of being mere appearances that arise from latencies and so forth. Right, so external objects are devoid of entity, so they're empty. What are they empty of? You know, they're empty of existing as external objects. Not being external objects, they're mere appearances that arise from latencies and so forth. So just like the appearances in dreams. So that's all a table or a blue or a tree or a herd of, you know, anything like that is. It's just appearances arising from latencies. So forms and so forth appear to exist externally, but do not. Just like the mansion, elephant, horse, and so forth, seen in a dream, they appear to exist externally, but do not. So I would put in that last sentence, they appear to exist externally, but do not. So the ladies who wrote this text, maybe that's... I thought, yeah, it's not that they don't exist, but they don't exist externally. Yeah, and then number 18, here we have the image of an echo. So they're like echoes. They bear the characteristic of external objects not having been produced. So what does that mean, not produced? Well, you have to use your ingenuity. So when one shouts in an empty house, an echo is produced. Although it appears that the voice is produced by the house, it does not exist in that way. I don't know whether you make what sense you make of that. I mean, the echo one, I would have thought, if you're in your mind only using the example of an echo, it's like you shout at a cliff or something, and then the voice comes back to you from a cliff, doesn't it? If you shout hello, and then a second later, hello comes back to you from the cliff. If you remember doing that when you were a kid, you know, it's like there's somebody talking to you, isn't it? You say hello, and then somebody says, oh, hello back. So it appears when you get the second, you know, you get the second hello, the hello from the echo, it seems like it's the voice is coming from the side, from the outside, isn't it? But in fact, it's just it's produced by you. It's just, a reflection of your own, self. It's produced by you. So I thought that's how you use the idea of an echo, for the mind only. It appears to exist from out there. It appears like somebody's talking to you, hello. But it's just produced by your own efforts. It's produced by your own mind, the echo. So I'd have thought it would be like that. Yes, once you start, it's not a completely perfect metaphor or whatever in every aspect, just in the sense that the voice is coming from that side, but in fact you've just produced it. That's just trying to interpret these things in a way that makes sense. Maybe the ladies who wrote the book have, they've got it right. I don't know, but I'm trying to make sense of it. Yeah, it appears that the voice is produced by the house, or if it's a cliff, but it's not produced like that. It's produced by you. So that's a similarity, and you can understand the absence of external phenomena in that way. On number 19, like double images, bear the existence of external objects not ceasing. Well, if you talk about double images, that's something like the double moon, like a drunken person sees two moons because they can't focus their eyes properly. Or people with some types of eye disease, they have the same problem. It's not that you have to be drunk, it can be a kind of problem with your eyes too. That's just an ordinary illness. Okay, so there's no two moons out there, but there's two moons appearing to you. So where are they coming from? Well, the double moon has no problem appearing, even though there aren't two moons out there. You see, so it's just another image by which you can understand that there's no need for external phenomena to be there in order for you to have appearances to your eye consciousness and so forth. So it's just another way of challenging our ordinary way of thinking about these things. And supporting the mind-only view. Or we have number 20, like mirages, bear the characteristic of external objects being pacified from the beginning. So a mirage is the appearance of water that comes about due to the condition of hot sun shining on a flat surface, while in reality there is no water there from the beginning. So you've got this idea of, you've got to explain being pacified from the beginning, that's the actual phrase that's in the sutra. So the mirage is beginninglessly not water. The mirage never was water. Beginninglessly it was not water. So form, beginninglessly has not been an external object or something. I don't know how you explain that. But anyway, you can have water appearing in a mirage. There's no water there in the external world. But you've still got the appearance of water to your mind. So just like that, ordinary water is just like that. It appears to exist as if externally, but there's no external water at all. It's just an appearance to your mind. Even actual water is the same. And number 21, illusions bear the characteristics of external objects having passed beyond sorrow by nature. So we have illusions such as women, horses, elephants and so forth are creations made by a magician through the power of substance and mantra that trick the eye of the spectators. Although these creations appear to be real, they are not. Yeah, so the forms like horses and cows and illusions and elephants that are created by a magician, they're illusions. They appear to exist externally, but naturally pure or something, passed beyond sorrow by nature. I think naturally pure. That's maybe a slightly better translation. I don't know. Naturally pure. So that the world just isn't like that. The world is naturally pure of being like that. But you're just seeing these things through the impurities of your own mind. It's not that the world is like that, it's just that your mind is like that, casting up these appearances to you. So those are, the kind of points you'll get Those words are not from the Ornament for Clear Realizations. Ornament for Clear Realizations is just much briefer than that. But when you go into the enumerate the points, then this is the kind of thing you'll come across. So that's as it appears in the sutra. But now we have to get our minds around this mind-only view. We could, you know, this would be a starting point for us to debate the mind-only view. When you're studying Ornament for Clear Realizations, you study that in chapter one more, because that's where you go into the question of the interpretable and the divinative, which of the three wheels of the Buddha's turning of the wheel of Dharma, which were to be taken literally, which are to be interpreted as not the final view. And it's at that point the mind-only view gets debated. I think some of you have been studying with Geshe Tashi, that book, the sort of interpretable and definitive essence of true eloquence. But anyway, we can use this as a place where, you know, you go back to the mind-only view and take a look at it. And to help you on that, there's stuff set out in the handout, the new handout for this week. So I suggest as your kind of, you know, discussion group activity after lunch for 20 minutes or so, then you look at this one. So the first page and the top of the second page, we have just some description of mind-only view. So if you'd just like to read through that. So if you could come up with a couple of points yourself then, you know, bring up, can you make a couple of points in favour of the mind-only view, which makes you think it's a good way of looking at things? Or maybe a couple of points against the mind-only view, and sort of, you know, thinking why it's sort of a view that isn't acceptable. So maybe you could do that as your activity after lunch. So I don't know how you're going to make the groups up. So 2 4s and 1 3 then, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So just to say that in the Western system also, there's this idea of idealism, you know, just all there is the mind, has come up. Western philosophy. So who is the Western philosophy most associated with this view? Bishop Berkeley. Thank you. So he is mentioned at the bottom of the page. We'll just look at him, the last thing before lunch. So the last paragraph on page one. Yeah, so this thing came up. There's people like Hume and this time in the 18th century when idealism was, you know, given a run for its money, also in Western philosophy. Oh, maybe that's the solution. So he was actually Irish, 1685 to 1753. So he's Western philosophy's best known denier of external things. He too contended that objects like tables, chairs, blue and sound are only ideas in the minds of perceivers. You know, put there by God in his case. You know, when you look behind the actual table that's appearing to your mind, then why do you have to posit some sort of solid object behind there? That's just an illusion. So who puts the illusion? Who puts the appearance of table to your mind? Then God. It's God working in his mysterious way. It's not karma. God. He was a bishop, you know. So he was like a he wasn't some sort of wacky guy who was kicked out of the church. A bishop in the Anglican church, you know, the in Ireland, but it's the Anglican, you know, sort of a Protestant bishop, I think. Okay, so if things are only ideas in the minds of perceivers, one thing that will crop up, if so, then what happens to them when nobody happens to be looking at them or thinking about them? So if we all go out of this room and have our lunch, what happens to that table? It's only an appearance of our mind. So what happens to it then? Ronald Knox composed the following limericks. You know, they're talking about the tree in the quadrangle in the university, you see? Okay, so when we all go to sleep at night, so this tree just disappears, does it? Because there's nobody looking at it. So there's somebody who's worried about that, and he said, there was a young man who said, God must find it exceedingly odd to see that this tree still continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. So, God has the last word, of course. Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad. And that's why the tree still continues to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God. Yeah, he says, don't worry about things not being there when nobody's looking at them. God's looking at them. But he's taking care of it. But we, being Buddhists, we don't have God to fall back on. What are we going to do? Please discuss. So, back after lunch at 2:15. So the cafe is open, is it? Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum.